Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Aaron David Miller was a top U.S. Middle East negotiator for most of two decades, from Oslo and before to 9/11. He was there, watching, advising in the thick of America's peacemaking coups, missteps, and meltdowns. In a new book, Miller asks why the world's greatest superpower has failed to broker peace in the Middle East and maybe has failed to look out for its own vital interests along the way. Joining me now in our studio is Aaron David Miller. Between 1988 and 2004, he was there for virtually every Arab-Israeli negotiation involving the U.S. at the White House, at Camp David, in the Israeli cabinet room, in Yasser Arafat's bombed-out Ramallah compound. He was advisor to six U.S. Secretaries of State under George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and the sitting president. His new book, a compelling mix of memoir and foreign policy, is The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. Aaron David Miller, welcome back to On Point.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
Secretary of State James Baker used to joke that you were peace processors or food processors, as he called it. Kind of a hard-bitten attitude toward it. And yet, just last fall, sitting president said, we're going to do this, and we're going to do it before I'm out of office. We're going to make it happen. Any sign in Condoleezza Rice's most recent trip to Israel and Jordan that progress has been made?
No, and Tom, I'm afraid this is no longer an American story. It's been a very interesting four-month period. If you look back in the history of the Arab-Israeli peace process, you would never have found a similar four-month period in which January in 2008, the president conducts negotiations with the Arabs and the Israelis. In February, the Secretary of State does. In March, the Vice President goes and the Secretary of State, and the president's due back again. And yet very little is emerging from our efforts. If something does happen, it will happen because two guys, Ehud Olmert and Mahmoud Abbas, want to, by the end of this year, reach an agreement, a piece of paper, on the four core issues that drive the Israeli-Palestinian conflict: borders, Jerusalem, refugees, and security. But it's very much their story these days, not ours.
Does that mean we're out of it, that the American role is a thing of the past? If it was ever going to make it happen, that it won't now?
It means that having disengaged from this issue, and my last chapter on George W. Bush is called The Great Disengager, having disengaged from this issue for most of his first term and for much of his second, and prompted only by his Secretary of State, who does want to do some serious business but is going to have a very difficult time doing it, it's very late for the United States to get into this game right now, and very difficult for me, even if I were to recommend an alternative approach, what it is we would do. Governing is about choosing. That's what it means to govern. And this administration has chosen, for most of its two terms, different priorities.
And yet you write that fundamental national security interests for the United States are at stake when we look at the Arab-Israeli conflict, when we look at the need for some kind of settlement there. Is that less true now than before?
No, I think it's more true now than ever before. I'm in the wrong city to say this, but the great Yankee manager, Casey Stengel, once said that the key to good management was keeping the nine guys who hate your guts away from the nine guys who haven't made up their minds. And there are a lot of people in this region who have not made up their minds about America. This issue, the Arab-Israeli issue, will not protect American interests like some magic amulet or elixir.
If it's solved or addressed or at least worked with.
Exactly. But it will. It will, because it's an issue that resonates with such passion, such fury, such intensity out there. It will help our friends, and it will, to some degree, eliminate the opportunities for our adversaries, and we need to be on the right side of it, and frankly, we haven't been.
I want to get a sense of the sweep of history that you're describing in this book. You've got a lot of personal involvement here. You're there with Yasser Arafat sitting in his sort of moldering little bedroom not long before his death. When he's saying it's got to be the United States, the U.S. has to be involved here, you said you'd taken that as just sort of talk for a long time. But at that moment, it read to me like you believed it. Long history here. Let's just get a sense of it. Aaron David Miller brings a lot of it to us in his book, Too Much Promised Land. Let's go back nearly 30 years here to March 1979 at the White House. Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin signed a historic peace treaty brokered by President Carter. Here Jimmy Carter expresses his hope for enduring peace.
So let us now lay aside war. Let us now reward all the children of Abraham who hunger for a comprehensive peace in the Middle East. Let us now enjoy the adventure of becoming fully human, fully neighbors, even brothers and sisters. We pray God together that these dreams will come true. I believe they will.
High rhetoric, high hopes with Jimmy Carter there. Fast forward to 1993. Everybody remembers it. Oslo peace negotiation was winding down on the White House lawn. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands. President Bill Clinton looked on and spoke of the work ahead.
What these leaders have done now must be done by others. Their achievement must be a catalyst for progress in all aspects of the peace process. And those of us who support them must be there to help in all aspects. For the peace must render the people who make it more secure.
And then in January of just this year, President Bush saying that there will be a solution by the time he leaves office.
I believe it's possible, not only possible, I believe it's going to happen, that there will be a signed peace treaty by the time I leave office. That's what I believe.
There it is. The great disengager, Aaron David Miller, calls him. You have interviewed an awful lot of presidents who have been involved with, a half dozen or nine secretaries of state. You've been in the middle of it yourself. Begin to give us your sort of reading on formulas that work and formulas that don't when it comes to encouraging some kind of a better outcome here. Clearly, disengaging hasn't brought us there.
No, it's true. And the problems have grown in complexity. You know, I'm a baseball fan, and I've established a Peace Process Hall of Fame. Three guys get in this Hall of Fame. Henry Kissinger for his disengagement diplomacy after the October 73 war. Jimmy Carter for his extraordinary effort to broker an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. And Jim Baker and George H.W. Bush, who put together the Madrid Conference in October of 1991. They all did different things, confronted different Arabs and Israelis, had different personalities. But four things drew these three together. Number one, they were tough when they had to be, with both Arabs and Israelis. Number two, they gained the trust, even though it was very difficult, of both Arab and Israeli leaders. Three, they were incredibly tenacious. They didn't give up, and they made this thing a national priority. And four, they had an exquisite sense of timing. They knew exactly what they could get away with. Unlike Bill Clinton, they didn't try to do too much. And unlike George W. Bush, they didn't take themselves out and not try to do anything. So the four T's of effective diplomacy, all of these have been missing, it seems to me, for at least the last 16 years.
That means not just George W. Bush, but Bill Clinton as well.
Absolutely. A man for whom I have tremendous admiration and respect, a man who cared more, who tried to do more, a man who had tremendous empathy for Arabs and Israelis. But in the end, a man, I think, who lacked the toughness and the determination that was required, even if an agreement were possible in July of 2000 at Camp David. And I argue in the book that it simply wasn't.
Toughness, you put at the top of that list, and you put a lot of emphasis on it here. All three of those that you laud as having been successful, Kissinger, Carter, Baker, willing to be tough. You have a reputation for talking about, for complaining that the U.S. had taken on the role where it needed to be an honest broker between these parties, had taken on the role of Israel's lawyer.
It's an interesting
your phrase.
Notion. My phrase. Actually, it's Kissinger's phrase, where I first discovered it in his memoirs, and we used it with Jim Baker, who not surprisingly really liked it. But I wrote an op-ed piece in May of 2005 in the Washington Post called Israel's Lawyer, and it was an elementally simple piece. I argued that if you want to be a mediator, your client has to be in agreement. Therefore, you need to be lawyers for both sides. And for too long, particularly in the Clinton administration, too many officials, including myself, and I put myself, this book isn't an I told you so, I put myself at the top of the list, far too often took Israel's point of view. And that op-ed has cost me, I've interviewed Gerry Ford before he died, George H.W. Bush, and Jimmy Carter. I've tried to get an interview with Bill Clinton, and he won't see me. So this notion that the United States sometimes sees the world primarily through Israeli interests, is one that needs to be carefully understood. We have a special relationship with Israel. Nobody wants to talk about it, but it is the key.
But people talk about it all the time, celebrate it.
It's true. But what they don't talk about is the fact that that special relationship, when used wisely, is the key to our influence in the Arab-Israeli arena. It's the paradox of the partial mediator. If we had no influence with the Israelis, guess what? The Arabs wouldn't be calling us. My point is that the special relationship is vital, and it's driven largely by value affinity. But when the special relationship becomes an exclusive relationship, when we don't ask Israel for reciprocity, when we acquiesce in too many Israeli decisions that don't make sense for America, we lose our credibility and we cannot succeed.
Has that special relationship overridden U.S. national interests?
I think in large part on the Arab-Israeli issue, we haven't looked after our own interests in the way we should have, I would argue, during the course of the last 16 years. This is not a Democratic problem. This is not a Republican problem. This is a problem that American presidents and secretaries of state, in a bipartisan way, are going to have to deal with.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with longtime U.S. Mideast peace negotiator Aaron David Miller, who's telling all or an awful lot now about his 20 years in the middle of Arab-Israeli talks and calling on the U.S. to get tough for Mideast peace and to get real about its importance to our own national security. His new book is The Much-Too-Promised Land, The Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. There's so much in here, and I want to get to all that we can, but you've got these great quotes from Anthony Lake first, Bill Clinton's first national security advisor, who said that the domestic U.S. politics behind this conversation around Mideast peace is like sex to the Victorians. Nobody talks about it, but it's on everybody's mind. That is, the politics going on back home, the lobbying, all the rest. You quote Abe Foxman, national director of the Anti-Defamation League, making the same point, saying the Jewish community wants to exercise power and influence, but we don't like it when people talk about it. So you're talking about it. What do we need to know here? I mean, everybody lobbies in the United States. Everybody's got an interest in something or other. Is there a problem with the Israeli lobby, the Israel lobby, or not?
You know, I interviewed John Sununu Sr., George H.W. Bush's chief of staff and former governor of New Hampshire. And Sununu said to me, look, stop whining about the lobby, the Israeli lobby, the Arab lobby. The fact is, read the Constitution. The way the system is set up is that it's designed to be lobbied. I don't think that's the real question. I don't fault the lobbies for wanting to lobby. The issue is whether or not a president is going to articulate an interest working with Arabs and Israelis, recognizing an opportunity, make Arab-Israeli peace a priority, and then pursue it. And you know what happens when that happens? In the case of Kissinger, Carter, and Baker, they succeeded, and the lobbies usually follow, sometimes angrily, sometimes noisily, but in essence, they follow. The debate is not an honest one. I think that's my point. And I went out to try to make it honest by talking to the lobby and the lobbied.
Where's the gap in honesty? Where's the dishonesty in our conversation with ourselves?
I think the gap is many in the Jewish community do not want to acknowledge the role that domestic politics plays in shaping American attitudes and actions, particularly in Congress.
When you say domestic politics, what do you mean? I mean, it sounds a little euphemistic.
Well, I mean the pro-Israeli community writ large, not just 5.3 million American Jews, but millions of evangelical Christians and a lot of other Americans who are not fundamentalist Christians who have over time, for many reasons, come to support the idea and reality of the security of the state of Israel, a fellow democracy. I put a lot of stake in value affinity, the notion that Americans support Israel because they believe that the Israelis are more or less like them. But that's not the only reason. It's a balance between that value affinity and the power of the pro-Israeli community to make a very effective argument. The discussion is not honest because while the elements in the Jewish community want to make it all value affinity, others, and I've been on this show with Professor Walton Mearsheimer, want to attribute it to the narrow notion of political power. And it's much bigger than that. That's what I think they misunderstand. The idea and reality of Israel has worked itself into American culture, mm-hmm. American politics, American psychology, and American foreign policy. I go as far in the book as to say that the debate between Israel supporters and detractors in America is basically over. Most Americans accept, most American presidents, mm-hmm. politicians accept the fact that the survival of the state of Israel is an important American interest and it's good for America. I continue to assert that's absolutely right. It's when the special becomes the exclusive and we forget about America.
The special relationship becomes an exclusive.
An exclusive one that we get ourselves into trouble.
You say we've had the two most friendly presidents to Israel in the history of the country with Clinton and George W. Bush somewhere in this book.
No argument there.
You say this debate is over. And yet you say that a kind of toughness on both sides is necessary if there's going to be effective pushing, real pushing for peace here. Well, does that mean that it's not going to happen anymore because, you know, we've chosen a side and that's that?
There's one point.
It's an ally, not a partner to be brokered with.
I mean, let me make two points. Number one. And I'll use a biblical metaphor here. Mm-hmm. You can't make bricks without straw. Mm-hmm. And I think all of your listeners, and I remind myself of this every single day, unless the Arabs and Israelis are willing to summon up the political will to make these very difficult decisions, I don't care what an American president does, he or she is not going to be able to succeed. But even if you have the straw to make the bricks, I'm arguing in the book you need a brick maker. And it is that role that is very, very difficult for Americans to play. My friend Larry Summers has said a lot of controversial things, but one thing he has said, which is beyond doubt, and that is this. In the history of the world, nobody ever washed a rental car. You only care about what you own. And unless the president of the United States makes Arab-Israeli peace, building on these opportunities or these crises, a priority, nobody is going to take us seriously.
But we've gone in a different direction. You write that that in a way, American politics have now become Israeli politics. I wasn't sure what you meant by that.
What I mean is that the debate is essentially over. It's not a Republican or a Democratic issue. The debate in America now is how active American politicians should be with respect to this process. How opposed should they be to settlement activity? How far should they push the Israelis? What should they do about the problem of Hamas and a divided Palestinian polity? The issue is no longer over the essential support for the well-being, sovereignty, and security of the state of Israel. That is done. The question now is, like Israeli politics, how active, how forthcoming, how tough or not tough should we be in an effort to try to get something done?
But it sounds as though you're saying we've moved into a different era where maybe our seat at the table isn't there anymore. Maybe we've stepped away from it as a country. You know, you say the most important ones here are Abbas and Olmert. Maybe that was always true. Maybe it was a delusion that the United States could arrive with all its superpower glory and push this to peace.
It's not a delusion because in the Peace Process Hall of Fame, you've got three Americans who demonstrated that if the straw is there to make the bricks, they can help the Arabs and the Israelis actually reach agreements. No, I think the question is the balance between what is the responsibility that Israelis and Palestinians have to take, and then what does America do in the face of the crisis and opportunities that they confront? We need to do a better job at managing this problem. And for the last 8 years, I do not fault Bill Clinton for the fact that he engaged in this issue. He deserves enormous credit for engaging. Mm. My only critique of him is that he wasn't tough enough. In this administration, we've been, frankly, neither empathetic or tough. We've essentially taken ourselves out of the game. And I have to tell you, if you ask me right now, is Israeli-Palestinian peace possible in the near term? I would say absolutely not. The situation has become so fundamentally complicated that the timeline for reaching a conflict-ending agreement is way out in the future. And that's something else we're going to have to find a way to rationalize and make a part of our policy, because it ain't happening quickly or easily.
That's costly for Israel, costly for the Palestinians. You say that unreachability in any near-term way of some peace, some settlement there is costly for the U.S. too. But define that cost for this country, because it can seem far away sometimes.
Well, what are our interests in the Middle East? It used to be a time when it was stopping the Soviet Union from gaining influence. That used to be the organizing principle around which we based our policy. Now it's changed. In the wake of 9/11, we confront a much different problem. If the organizing premise of any nation's foreign policy is how to protect the homeland, that, in effect, is the top foreign policy priority. And protecting the homeland means being smart and tough in that region. Yes, it means preempting terror. Yes, it means at times being tough, good intelligence. And yes, it may mean military action, but it also means effective diplomacy. And this issue, the Arab-Israeli issue, bangs around out there with a ferocity and an intensity that makes it almost imperative that we manage it better. And we're not on the right side of this. We talk about hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. It's not hearts and minds. You don't appeal to someone's emotions in the hopes that somehow they're going to like what it is you do. It's minds and hearts. You appeal to their cognitive abilities. Then they will come along. And our public diplomacy, frankly, has failed. The president says, well, they hate us because we love freedom. Well, the truth is there may be a disturbingly large minority of people out in that region who do hate us because we love freedom. But that's not the vast majority. The vast majority don't like us, not because of who we are. They love America. I mean, they send their kids to be educated here. They put their money here. They shop here. They vacation here. They don't like us, not because of who we are. They don't like us because of what we do. And one of the sources, not even the principal source necessarily, one of the sources of that rage and anger and humiliation is the perception that we aren't being real and effective on the issue of Arab-Israeli peace. That's what I'm suggesting. Let's get smart on this issue and do a better job of trying to manage it. Our national security depends on it.
Aaron David Miller has been in the room for years and years of those negotiations, and you hear the message he's coming out with. I want to turn to our listeners, if I may. We've got a lot to want to speak with you. Let's go first to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Shalom. Shalom, you're on the air with Aaron David Miller.
Yes. Hello?
Hello, you're on, sir.
Okay. I want to talk about American interests, and there is a massive denial of reality going on. Namely, the reality it's not in American interest to have nuclear holocaust in the Middle East and very likely destruction for hundreds of years to come of the oil fields, which will result if Israel is nuked, as the Iranians intend to do. This is massive denial of reality that all the Arab countries and their inhabitants, 85%, do not want peace really, but destruction of Israel. We are in the days like Chamberlain with Hitler in 1938, 70 years ago, and when Chamberlain came with the piece of paper agreement with Hitler, said, I brought you peace and honor in our time, Churchill shot back, you lost your honor already, you lose the peace. My question to Mr. Miller, why do you deny the reality, the intention of the Arabs, not just in the charter of Hamas and Hezbollah, but also in opinions of Arabs and the preachment of the mosque, not only in Gaza, is to destroy Israel. You don't negotiate with people who want to destroy you. And you don't address this question. Why not?
Shalom. Thank you very much. Aaron David Miller.
I'm sure, Shalom, there are a lot of people out there in that region who do feel the way that you describe. But I think it really, you talk about denying the reality. I think you're also denying the reality that over the course of the last 40 years, a conflict, the Arab-Israeli conflict that involved in phases, was essentially being resolved in phases. I mean, don't forget, you have two peace treaties that exist between Israel and Egypt, signed in March 79, as Tom pointed out, which has endured. It may not be perfect, but it's endured. You have an Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty, signed in October 1994, which has endured. You have an agreement, a disengagement agreement, from June of 1974 between Israel and Syria, which has lasted these many years and has made that border quiet. I don't agree with you that the vast majority of people in this region want this as an outcome. I think there's tremendous anger at the Israelis. If you're looking for a situation in which Israel is going to be Switzerland, loved, admired, and respected by their neighbors in perpetuity, you're not going to find that. But can you have a situation in which Israel has political agreements which endure over time, which eliminate conflict, and over time could usher in the way for normalized relations? Absolutely. And those agreements prove that it can be done. I do not accept the proposition, and as an American, it seems to me morally unacceptable to assert it, that never should be the reality. It's not right for someone who lives in the comfort and security of this country, including myself, to assert while they live here, freed from the existential dilemma and the pain and the suffering to which Arabs and Israelis are exposed, to basically give up and say we can't do it. It's hard, it's going to be excruciatingly painful, and I'll borrow a quote from Jack Kennedy. He was the first and last president to motivate me in any way, and it's his city here. He described himself as an idealist without illusion. Never give up on changing the world, the possibility. But as you go through it, do so with your eyes open.
Let's take a call from Middlesex, Vermont. Tom, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I agree with a lot of what your guest says, but I'm especially with the point that we really have to examine what our interests are. And I think to cut through all of the issues, what we should do as a nation, unilaterally if necessary, or with our allies if we can get them to join us, is simply to recognize the state of Palestine. That will completely change the conversation. It will also convince, I think, most Arabs that the United States genuinely does support their legitimate interests and aspirations.
But don't you have to have an understanding, an envelope for that recognition? I mean, President Bush has already said he welcomes a two-state solution, but it's not quite as simple as that, is it, Tom?
I think it is. If the United States says that it recognizes the state of Palestine, specifies the borders which it recognizes...
Without asking Israel, without negotiating those borders?
Absolutely. We've been trying to negotiate them for 50 years. And it hasn't happened, and it's not going to happen, in my opinion.
Tom, thanks for your call. Aaron, what you're talking? Is that the toughness? Lay down the law from afar.
You know, if we were only that powerful and that strong. But one of the messages of this book, and one of my chapters is called Gulliver's Troubles, How a Great Power Survives in a World of Small Tribes, is that we are Gulliver. We do not have that capacity. Iraq is a cautionary tale. If you look at the history of the Middle East, what you see is literally the broken dreams, schemes, and ambitions of great powers who mistakenly believed that they could impose their will on small tribes. I'll tell you a story, Tom. In January of 1997, I was charged by the Secretary of State working with Yasser Arafat to go to the city of Hebron to measure the width of a road that had become a central sticking point in the Arab-Israeli negotiations.
Aaron, hold that thought. We'll bring it down to a single road when we come back. Aaron David Miller's new book is The Much Too Promised Land. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with longtime U.S. Mideast peace negotiator Aaron David Miller. His new book is The Much Too Promised Land, The Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. He joins me in the studio. Aaron, you were just in the middle of a story before we cut away there, which ended up having you with a tape measure sort of on your hands and knees on a road in the West Bank. Take us from the top of that story, if you would.
Yeah, I'm trying to make the point that we're like Gulliver, wandering around in a world of small tribes who draw us into their world and into the obsessiveness that defines it. So here I am, charged with measuring the width of a road. It barely broke 500 on my math SATs. I'm there with a tape measure, with a lot of security, because we're surrounded by heavily armed Israeli settlers and dour and very suspicious-looking Palestinians. And I'm down on my hands and knees, the representative of the superpower, measuring this road. I mean, the fact is, Arabs and Israelis are going to forget more about the details and the intricacies of these issues than we're ever going to know. And we got to get something straight right from the beginning. We have a critical role to play, but unless they're willing for their own political reasons to push forward, we're not going to be able to play that role.
But you say get tough, and yet, you know, here we are. Condoleezza Rice just left Israel on Monday. She failed to halt leaders there, to persuade leaders there to halt settlement construction. And, you know, within hours of her leaving, you've got permission for 800 more homes on the West Bank. Never mind the nitty-gritty detail. We don't seem to have any cloud at all there. She was just there.
That's right. And I can't remember in the 20 years I participated in the formal official diplomacy that we ever had an honest discussion with the Israeli government about settlement activity or the need to restrict it or stop it. I mean, Jim Baker found a way by using housing loan guarantees to deny Israel or at least to deduct from the dollars we were prepared to give the Israelis to absorb Russian Jews to build housing. Every dollar that the Israelis spent on settlement activity was to be deducted from the $10 billion in housing loan guarantees that we were prepared to secure. But we don't get tough with the Israelis on settlement activity. Frankly, in the 90s, when I worked for Bill Clinton, we weren't tough enough on the Palestinians either on issues like incitement or corruption or acquiescence in terror and violence. And I guess that's my basic point. If you want to be respected out there and ultimately trusted, you're going to have to not only bring about tough love, you're going to have honest conversations. And if the Arabs and Israelis don't want to go forward, they don't accept what we propose, fine. But then don't lend our credibility to a process that is not honest. And in fact, that's part of the problem that we witness today. We have a roadmap. It's a perfectly fine document.
Mm-hmm.
But that roadmap is not being adhered to or respected by either Israelis or Palestinians. One additional point, Tom. You have a much more complicated situation now on the Palestinian side. Forget two states. You run the risk now of three states.
With Hamas and Gaza.
Which is the state of Israel, Hamas is ensconced in Gaza, and Abbas in the West Bank. And the reality is, if you were to ask me right now, what is the greatest obstacle to the pursuit of an Israeli-Palestinian negotiating process that could pay off, it's not Israeli settlement activity.
Mm.
It's the reality that on the Palestinian side, no single entity controls all of the guns. That is an absolutely elemental fact, because if you don't control the guns in your society, whether it's the city of Boston or Chevy Chase, Maryland, where I live, or Egypt, not only will your constituents not respect you, but your neighbors won't either.
But what about, you know, Shalom raised earlier in his call, I mean, he talked about the threat of a nuclear war in the region, but he also raised this fundamental issue about whether or not this is a region that is ultimately willing to accept the very existence of Israel there. My old friend Steve Erlanger, leaving Israel, he's been there for the New York Times, and on his way out he's writing about the kind of incendiary language from Hamas that's so vituperative and directly, you know, against the sort of agreements in Oslo and again in 2003 that said, hey, we're going to, the roadmap that said we're not going to throw those kind of insults at one another. It's still there, though, and you know that leads people to think, well, there's nothing to do here but for Israel to dig in its heels, and if the U.S. is a friend of Israel, to dig in its heels right beside us, because it's never going to be accepted, you know, just to be, just to live there.
No, I think it's a very fair and elemental point, but it doesn't motivate Israeli prime ministers. I mean, this is something that Israel's supporters in the United States have to understand. Every Israeli prime minister, the six that I worked with, each in their own way, pursued this process, tested the proposition that there could be agreements with their neighbors. This is not an American design. It's not up to America to decide for Israel or for the Palestinians what the existential concessions are that needs to be made.
What are you saying there, that Americans are more worried than Israeli prime ministers about that country's existence?
I am saying that the debate in America is much less rational, in some respects, much more separated from reality than the actual discourse in Israel. And the reason for that, it seems to me, is that the farther away you get from the center of the conflict, the less people have to lose. I can't tell you how many times in speaking across America, I've had Arab Americans or Jewish Americans stand up and say to me, we can never do this. Mm-hmm. We will never accept Israel's right to exist. We will never give the Golan back. And I say to them, wait a minute. What do you mean we? Where's the we? I see you living in Dearborn or Chevy Chase or New York City or Los Angeles in the comfort and security of this extraordinary country, freed from the existential realities of putting your kids on a bus in the morning and wondering whether or not they're going to come home. And then I see the Arabs and the Israelis. There's no we here. There's you and there's them. So let the Arabs and the Israelis sort this process out. And my conclusion from all of this is the nature of the debate in America is so skewed because people have less of a stake, frankly, less to lose here in the outcome.
But Jewish Americans or Arab Americans may be doubly fierce in their passion about this exactly because they're far from it, maybe feel guilty, want to support the people who are in the midst of it. I mean, you're Jewish American yourself. You know this community well. Your family's been very active in the community. You know the passion and effort that people pour into this issue. Are you saying that that, in the end, is not helpful toward Israel's own peace and stability, or for that matter, toward American interests?
Look, there's nothing wrong with passion and commitment. I mean, life is going to be pretty meaningless if you don't care about things that make sense and are worthwhile. But that passion, it seems to me, can create a credibility problem. It means you're not perceiving the real world in which Arabs and Israelis live. Of course it's excruciatingly painful. Of course it's frightening. And and of course it involves matters of life and death. But let the Arabs and the Israelis, who live on top of the volcano, make their own decisions. Don't make it any harder for them by distorting the dialogue. I used to run Seeds of Peace. We had Israeli and Palestinian kids who've
this
had
is,
their,
this is the that brings Israelis and Palestinian kids together outside the arena.
Right. Brings them to America, puts them together for 3 weeks, and you watch the extraordinary transformation that takes place. And these kids have lost, they've lost their childhoods, they've lost friends, they live in this extraordinarily threatening world. And yet, they manage to come together and to reach out to the so-called other in a way that American Arabs and Jewish Americans have never been able to do. And I ask myself, why is that? There's got to be a reason. And the reason, it seems to me, is I think in large part it is driven by a sense of, well, whether guilt is the right word, it's driven by a sense that we care, but we can afford to make these positions clear and passionate because in the end, we really don't have that much to lose. It's the Arabs and the Israelis who really have the most to lose.
Let's go to Harrisonburg, Virginia, and Larry. Larry, you're on the air with Aaron David Miller.
Hi. The gentleman there talked about lasting peaces that were made. That Jordan made a lasting, Jordan and Egypt and Syria made a lasting peace with Israel.
Not so much Syria, but Jordan and Egypt certainly, yes.
Right. Well, the Syrians shuttle Iranian material support to terrorists through Lebanon to the hands of Hezbollah, and it's funneled out of Egypt into the Gaza for Hamas. And as long as the people of Iran and Saudi and Syria see Palestinians killing Jews and then Palestinians bearing all of the consequences for the Israeli reprisals and the Israeli defense forces trying to protect Israel, that they're quite happy with that status quo because it's not their blood being shed and Jews are still being killed. And then they mouthed something different in the international community and the U.S. negotiators. And I don't know how you stop that situation without, you have to stop the flow of arms to Hezbollah and Hamas to have a lasting peace.
Yeah, Larry, you've got a lot on the table there. Aaron David Miller, what do you say in response?
Well, first of all, let's focus on what I said. I said there are treaties of peace between Israel and Egypt, Israel and Jordan, and there's a disengagement agreement which has made the Israeli-Syrian border the quietest since the modern conflict began. A lot of what the caller says is absolutely right. The regional environment right now is poisonous for promoting and cultivating the kind of conflict and an agreement that is necessary. In three places, Iraq, Palestine, and Lebanon, you have an authority deficit. You have small groups, Hamas, Hezbollah, and in Iraq, a variety of Sunni and Shia groups, which challenge every single day the authority and the power, not only of the central governments, but of American military and economic power. So that's a huge problem. And the truth is, talking to the Syrians and the Iranians may prove to be a key to an empty room right now, but it's still, in my judgment, worth doing, because you're never going to be able to promote this process without a regional environment that is much less poisonous than the one we have now.
Let's take another call from Harold in Quincy, Massachusetts. Harold, you're on the air.
Good program. I support a lot of what you've said. Let me ask you about another bit of imbalance in our support systems. You know, we're on the border of Iran, and there's been talk of attacking them possibly because of their nuclear development. How come in all these years Israel has been free from any kind of nuclear investigation by the UN and other non-proliferation attitudes in the world? Is that not also a very imbalanced ingredient that promotes a hell of a lot of the discord that's going on over there?
But Harold, let me ask you.
I'm a Luntzman too.
You're what?
I'm a Luntzman of yours. I'm an Eastern European Jew, but I don't like the imbalance that I see that's going on over there. The Palestinians are not getting very much, and Israel has been getting tons of military and financial support from America, and they're free to develop their nuclear programs without even a question.
But does it make a difference, Harold? Let me ask you, that Iran calls the U.S. or has called it the great Satan. Israel's a long way from that.
Look, I'm not getting into Satan and devils and all that. Yeah. Religion is another issue I don't want to touch today. Give me an answer. Thank you.
You got it, Aaron.
You know, America can't control the world. I mean, one of the things that emerges from this book is the fundamental reality that as big and as tough and as powerful as we are really also very distant. Small powers will do just about anything to create a measure of deterrence and to survive. And the fact is, yes, even though the Israelis don't acknowledge it, they have deliverable nuclear devices. Would they ever use them? Maybe they would if it was an existential issue. The Indians have them. The Pakistanis have them. And the Iranians probably are several years away from crossing the threshold to actually weaponizing. There's very little, frankly, that a great and distant power could do about this specific problem. As you know, the only time nuclear weapons have ever been used was in August of 1945.
But you could build a global non-proliferation network and really stick with it, really
well,
mean it.
You could, maybe.
You could disarm as an example.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's going to be such a compelling argument. But let me just give you one, make one point. We invaded Iraq on the front end on the assumption that there were weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological. And it was a stretch, but perhaps even the president thought that Iraq had an incipient nuclear capability. None of that was true. But in the last 5 years, our policies in Iraq have leveled the playing field for the one nation that is now in the process of actually developing a real, deliverable nuclear weapon. We eliminated the Taliban, an Iranian adversary. We eliminated Saddam, an Iranian adversary. And the irony of ironies is this, that on the watch of George W. Bush, Iran may well just pass the nuclear threshold. So we have a way, it seems to me, of making matters worse.
We've got 1 minute to go here. Let me answer this question then. I have a feeling Americans are feeling like disengaging rather than engaging from this Mideast peace process. It's gone on so long. You say that would be a huge mistake. In a minute, the U.S. should stay engaged in this process and push it toward a peaceful solution because?
because we have friends who depend on us, Arab and Israeli friends, for whom continuation of this problem is going to be a lot worse, because we have enemies who really are our enemies, for whom continuation of this problem will provide ample opportunities, and because America essentially also must associate itself not just with preventative and preemptive military action, not just with Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. America is more than that. We need an effective, assertive diplomacy to persuade the rest of the world as well that we are a positive force for change. We've demonstrated that commitment in the past, and we can perhaps demonstrate it again in the future.
Aaron David Miller, his new book is The Much Too Promised Land. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Chelsea Mers, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Jamie Katsoufis and Ping Huang. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.